Hello, fine listener. This is Scott Price, and you're listening to CKUW 95.9 FM. And this is a show called Radio Free World, CKUW's weekly look to the news happening outside of the Perimeter Highway. As you would have heard, there's some problems with debt and the debt ceiling in the United States. There's been some wrangling and some wrestling going on between the Democrats and the Republicans. To talk about all that, I brought in Brian Kelsey. He is a writer, speaker, and public policy consultant specializing in local and regional policy management, fiscal reform, and regulatory policy. He runs the site stateofthecity.ca. Right now, we're going to hear an interview with that I conducted with him all about the debt ceiling in the United States, possible impacts, and outcomes. So they've agreed on a deal, the Republicans and Democrats, tentatively, I guess. I think there might be a couple things that they have to iron out. So what is your initial reaction to all this?
Well, my initial reaction, I guess, to listeners is first that it's important to be following this for your own, you know, financial well-being and well-being as a voter, just as much as it is out of any interest you might have. And I think it's also important to not do what, you know, both parties in Congress and in the White House did, and not fall into the trap when you're looking at this of being too partisan or too ideological about it. And the problem really is that during the debt ceiling negotiations, you had really two legitimate positions that were being inexpertly, you know, floated in really badly managed negotiations. But that doesn't change the fact that there were two legitimate positions on either side of the table. And both sides did some crazy things, you know, that should generate some disgust on the part of American voters, if not Canadian voters. But the legitimate part of that conversation was twofold. First, that you have debt ceiling legislation in the United States that's designed to help the administration, not to hurt it, by freeing up the administration to borrow to a certain level so they don't have to keep going back to Congress for approval of every bond issue or whatever, which they used to have to do before the First World War. And it's quite legitimate of the Democrats to have said, you know, there is no plan on the table that gets us out of a deficit in this fiscal year, even from the most extreme Republicans. So it's totally fair for them to have been saying, we're going to need to lift this debt ceiling now to take care of, you know, the day-to-day problems we're dealing with on you know, the budget they're operating on and the fiscal commitments they've already made. But by the same token, that I expect a lot of your listeners would probably think the Republican position was totally illegitimate. But it wasn't just a debt ceiling crisis. It's also a debt crisis. And that debt crisis, I think, is going to continue to be a topic of conversation, whatever happens with this deal in Washington, for a few years, because the whatever you think about public debt, that the American debt in terms of how it's structured right now and who it's owed to and how it's accumulating has some problems in there that should be alarming even for fiscal progressives, let alone for fiscal conservatives. So those two positions were clashing. And the challenge for both sides was to try and come up with a deal that accommodated both sides at the same time. And to make matters worse, if you look at the real text of the deal that they've got, all they've done is more or less deferred the real decisions until, you know, December and January of next year. But the debt ceiling problem, at least for the short term, has been solved in exchange for that commitment.
Right. Now, a lot of people, I've been following it, and I guess I've heard it quite a number of times, people saying, well, it's not really a problem. This is a kind of a created problem. The Republicans are kind of making a big thing out of this because, for the most part, they don't have to compromise anything, right? Because they want to cut government anyways.
Well, there's a let's come back to the problems with the Republican position in a second, because certainly there's some things I would disagree with in terms of how they handled this. Nevertheless, debt, I would hope, the U.S. debt in particular, should look like a problem to almost every voter for a few reasons, and let's walk through them. First, we're talking about $14.3 trillion of debt that's accumulating, you know, give or take in any given year of the fiscal plan going forward for the next 10 years, anywhere between $500 billion and $1 trillion each additional year. And as the economy, you know, isn't recovering, those numbers can get worse if revenues get worse and so forth. Now, you know, in previous years or during World War II or World War I or whatever, you know, 100% GDP going to debt wasn't as catastrophic, in part because the Americans were largely repaying that debt to themselves. And so it was easier to move money around to do that and to manage the debt market in that sense, because the normal person buying treasury bills or war bonds in 1944 and 45 was, you know, a family sitting at home that wasn't going to, you know, pull the rug out from under the United States, right? They're pulling their own rug out. Right now, the way the debt's structured is one of the problems, and that is that a good chunk of that debt, between 30 and 40% off the top of my head, is foreign-owned. And it's market-owned, and that means that if there is a panic, the market can start imposing higher interest rates on the United States. And if interest rates start going north, as they're doing in Greece, as markets are doing with Greek debt right now and Portuguese debt, and they're starting to do with Italian debt, that means you're paying far more in debt interest just to finance the same level of services. So mm-hmm. if you like government services, you should be interested in keeping that debt interest figure managed down as much as possible. The second problem with how it's structured is that, unlike debts during, you know, post-war debts in the past, a good deal of that debt, roughly $4 trillion or so, give or take, is owed to the United States government. It literally owes itself in the sense that it issued bonds to the Social Security Trust Fund and the Medicare Trust Fund, so that essentially as promissory notes to say, we'll get back to you, we got to get back to these funds and repay this debt. So again, if you have some sort of financial crisis where you're defaulting on your debt, your deficit actually starts to skyrocket, almost like a firestorm, in the sense because you're now not paying in to meet not only the cash flow you need to manage Social Security, which is pretty important. You also owe your Social Security fund and your Medicare trust fund at the same time. Last but not least, and this doesn't get talked about much in the media in the States right now, the reason I think the situation is alarming is that in the next 4 years, a good deal of the debt that the U.S. borrowed during the financial crisis in 08 and 09 was short term. Canada and the United Kingdom did the right thing and borrowed long term, very low interest rates. It costs more, you know, 10, 20, 30 years out, but it means you don't have to refinance that debt. A lot of people who talk about debt don't realize that, you know, when bonds come due, you still got to pay those bonds. And how governments tend to do that is you borrow again to replace that. And you pray that the interest rate is lower when you refinance. The problem we've got is it's almost certain that the interest rate's going to be higher in the next 4 years. And every time the interest rate's higher, that means, again, you're paying $50, $100, $200 billion more per year just to carry the same level of debt. Right now, Scott, roughly $4.5 trillion worth of U.S. debt comes due before 2016, which is, you know, compared to the $14.3 trillion, is a substantial chunk. Again, that figure's rising year over year. And this starts to become the Tommy Douglas argument as to why you should be fiscally responsible, is that they're literally in a position 3 or 4 years from now that if they haven't contained this and interest rates are double what they are now, which isn't crazy, 6%, you know, I've seen that most of my lifetime, and versus, say, 3 on a bond. If it's up at 6%, you're talking about paying $700-800 trillion a year just to service the same level of debt. Just because of a minor change, what would be in any other year, a minor change in interest rates. Right. That's the alarming part.
Yeah. Now, another point, though, is it's interesting. I forget exactly who said this, but or maybe it was the Washington Post, where they kind of said, like, they went from massive stimulus to massive restraint. In the sense that they're sort of kind of cutting back on all this stuff, even though the economy is not growing.
Well,
that sort of argument that the economy is not growing any, and now you're going to cut a bunch of this money that would have been used. I guess, you know, it's the Keynes sort of Keynesian kind of thinking, right? So what would be your response to that?
Two problems, and that is first that you know, it's obviously the job situation and the economic situation is a legitimate problem, and taking out, you know, so-called aggregate demand by slashing government spending is going to make that a tougher challenge, not an impossible one, but a tougher one. The problem the U.S. has right now is that they're dealing with multiple crises, as we all are, frankly, at the same time. And, and, you know, that's a consequence of dumb decisions that were made in the past, and we'll, you know, box that and put that away for now. But that the The issue here with debt is that if they didn't at least show some progress on the debt, well, you've got a major debt contagion happening in Europe, by the way, at the same time as they're trying to deal with the jobs problem, the risk is that the debt problem starts to make the job problem worse. And to a certain degree, I think you're seeing that in markets now anyway, is that there's this sense that nobody has any answers on either challenge right now. And so people are pulling money out of the economy, just as corporations have been doing for the last couple of years, and they're just sitting on cash and not investing it. But the other thing I think is important to emphasize is that first, roughly $1.5 trillion worth of the savings that they're talking about in the plan they've just agreed to with Congress and the White House a week or two ago. Roughly $1.5 trillion of the savings is anticipated defense savings from winding down operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. So that's demand that's, you know, other than salaries for soldiers and whatnot, that's not like we're talking about cutting infrastructure spending or unemployment benefits that are going to somebody in Ohio or whatever. The other the bulk of the other savings are spread out over 10 years in that plan that I, off the top of my head, I think next year they're talking about a $54 billion cut in discretionary spending. If you look at the whole package and sort of chart out the curve as a as deficits as a percentage of the total U.S. budget, this deal that's on the table right now doesn't even actually reduce spending over the 10-year period. It merely contains the growth to a manageable level. So they've only just got started. And I mean, what will look like cuts and tough decisions, I think, from the standpoint of political debate in the United States, from the standpoint of total government spending, you're still not actually going to be taking that much real money out of the economy until they start adding to that $2.5 trillion figure.
Another thing is interesting that through this whole thing is with the negotiations. I mean, on the one hand, I think in a lot of ways, a lot of people have been saying the Republicans now, in the long term, in a sense of loss, because now they're being defined by their most strident voices, their most, you know,
they always have been. And you know, certainly since, you know, the late 1990s.
So. But I mean, certainly with the Tea Party kind of element, I guess, is what, you know, it's what they're referring to. And also Obama always trying to look like being the center, the pragmatist.
Right.
But at the same time, letting the Republicans frame it. So, talk about that a bit.
Well, first, there was a great Onion headline about, and I'll try and paraphrase it, that President Obama says the deal proves that both sides, liberal Democrats and conservative Democrats, are able to cave in Washington to come to a good deal or whatever, to compromise. Yeah, to a degree that's true. I mean, if you look at the four or five different packages that were on the table over the course of these negotiations, I think, you know, from the standpoint of the president's reputation as a negotiator with his base, has been burned. a good deal of that conversation focused on the issue of tax increases. Two comments on that to sort of come at it from both sides. First, I think, you know, Canadians were a little warmer to taxes, especially at a point when there's clearly a national crisis going on, might be sort of shrugging their hands and shoulders, and saying, what's all the fuss about? Tax rates are where they were under Ronald Reagan or lower in the United States right now. Well, I think part of the legitimate reason there's some fuss is first that there's a recession, but secondly that the consumers are also massively in debt in the United States. And, you know, part of the problem is that we're trying to, the world is hoping to see a situation where Americans are containing that irresponsible debt at the same time as they're containing, their massive public debt as well. So that's a reason to say, let's not go, crazy on tax increases. On the other hand, where I think the Republican position was really irresponsible is that if you'd taken any, I've met a lot of Republicans and Democrats on political visits to the States. If you'd taken a typical Republican from, say, 1996 or 97 and said, I'm going to offer you a deal where we wipe out every tax deduction and come close to a flat tax. I mean, there'd still be tax brackets, but you wouldn't have all these complex deductions. You wouldn't have lobbyists coming to Congress saying, I want a deduction from, my best friend that's tailor-made to help him anymore. And in exchange, we're going to take that money and pay down the debt or pay down the deficit in a time of crisis. Most sane Republicans would have said, hey, that's a great deal. You're keeping the same tax rates. but you're getting rid of what's frankly a lot of distortion and even a lot of corruption that's built into the American tax system right now. Instead, you had exactly the opposite, that you have guys like Grover Norquist from Americans for Tax Reform, which is a counterpart of the CTF, a group I used to work for here, you know, standing up and saying that basically anything that increased revenue in his mind was a tax increase. And so anyone who had signed a pledge committing to support whatever Grover Norquist said, essentially, you know, was bullied into not considering this very responsible alternative to raise more revenue. I mean, these tax rates, remember, were tax rates that were voted in by Republican majority Congresses. So if they thought that those were honestly fair tax rates, you know, 6, 7, 8 years ago, you know, without deductions, right? Because you have to assume that some taxpayers won't get those deductions. It's really a true example of either hysteria or hypocrisy, I think, not to be, or both, not to be, given the situation the U.S. is in, willing to consider that. And something I've seen debated online that I want to make clear on this, there's mounds of research out there, and there'll be some skeptics when I say this, but go look for it, that demonstrates that overwhelmingly the beneficiaries from tax deductions of every possible kind, certainly in the U.S. tax system, and from what I've seen to a lesser degree in the Canadian tax system, the tax deduction system, the tax credit system, all those little benefits overwhelmingly benefit higher income earners rather than the lower income earners that they're supposedly created to benefit, especially the mortgage deduction in the U.S. It's like, you know, 80% of the cash benefit in terms of the cost of having that tax credit benefits the top decile of income earners in the United States. So it's a progressive thing to wipe those deductions out. And they're going to come back and look at that as part of this deal. But, you know, in Washington, coming back and looking at something often means you get the watered down version.
So. Right, right. Now, one last little thing on this. Also, too, through this whole process, I mean, a lot of Americans... I saw polls that were saying, okay, I mean, we have no problem with raising more revenue,
sure,
in this sort of thing. And their voice was not heard in that sense. And a lot of, as you pointed out at the beginning of this interview, a lot of them, as well they should be, were quite disgusted with this. So is this more even than just an exercise getting the fiscal house in order? Was this even more an exercise in creating apathy and disgust with government?
Yes, and I think part of that was circumstance, though, in the sense that you had, because the debt, the risk of not moving the debt ceiling was so high, that you really did have, I'm not afraid to say it, sort of a hostage-taking situation in terms of the politics of the negotiations there. And again, I want to emphasize, I mean, I think there's at least some merit in having used the debt ceiling issue this time around to have a conversation about the debt crisis, because there's two problems. There's the debt and the debt ceiling, and they're both separately legitimate problems. You know, in terms of people being left behind, I mean, I think, and left out, you know, all I've got really to say on that is more of a comment than a prediction or a suggestion or an analysis, and mm-hmm. that is that, you know, President Obama is president because of, you know, his team's legendary ground organizing skills. And there had been talk, if you remember, of, you know, everybody in his network being mobilized after he was president to push for different things and whatnot. I mean, I think we've clearly seen that exactly the opposite is happening, that, you know, Obama's starting to remind me of Hoover in terms of becoming more and more of a White House president during the recession and isolated from sort of the economic realities that are happening around him. And if there are Democratic voters and organizers out there who are, you know, grinding their teeth and saying, we've got an awful result, well, the reality is one of the reasons they got an awful result was they didn't turn out their voters, during the midterms. And, you know, whatever your political views, this is why politics matters, is that the Tea Party's voice is louder than, you know, I would like it to be as a moderate fiscal conservative. It's louder than, you know, everybody else at this stage, precisely because they showed up. And that's, you know, that's the lesson, I think, for the ordinary citizen out there is whatever result you want from all this, and in similar debates in Canada, whoever shows up, you know, is at least halfway towards winning.
Okay, so now let's move on to...
maybe that's a good segue to Rob Ford in Toronto.
Yes, exactly. So also there is these cuts in Toronto, but I mean, first, maybe just talk a little bit about the effect it could have on Canada. What could consumers?
Well,
I mean, obviously, there could be things that down the road that you could have never seen, but potentially, what are you seeing?
The biggest single point that I can easily make is that if I had been on your show, you know, every day for the last 2 years, the word I would have been muttering over and over and over again is complacency. That for good reasons and bad reasons, that we've got federal and provincial governments that have been, you know, bragging about the performance of our economies without really, you know, being candid with the public about just how fragile those benefits are. Right now, we're surviving almost entirely on the basis of stimulus spending on the one hand, which we can sustain a little more easily than the U.S., and high commodity prices, because there's heavy demand for those commodities, oil and nickel and whatever, in China and Brazil and other developing economies right now. So to give you an example of just how fragile our situation is, that the May numbers were just released a few days ago by Statistics Canada on GDP growth, and our economy shrunk by 0.3%. And it shrunk almost entirely on the basis of shrinkage in commodity prices that took place that particular month. That if oil prices continue to drop, and the last time I checked them this morning, they were starting to drop on the basis of reduced demand in the U.S. as a result of fears of low growth and a recession and just general panic about the state of the budget and the economy. If oil prices continue to drop, that's not good for the Saskatchewan economy, the Alberta economy, the Newfoundland economy. Federal tax revenues start to drop. Their ability to sustain, deficit spending starts to drop. And the short version is if you're a consumer, don't be getting yourself into heavy debt. Don't be, leveraging your mortgage more. That we never were out of the woods. It's just we happen to be a lucky corner of the economy at this point. And everybody should be treating this like it's a hard time, even if it doesn't feel like it right now in some quarters of the province. So.
For more views and opinions and analysis from Brian Kelsey, check out stateofthecity.ca, which has recently transitioned from a blog, and it's soon to be a research-based public affairs company. Check that all out at stateofthecity.ca. For CKUW, I'm Scott Price.